Hi everyone, we've got Professor Dylan Jones-Evans here with us today, the founder of the Wales Fast Growth 50 and Wales Startup Awards. And I am joined with Emily and Yuan from Williams Denton. And we're here to chat about Dylan's story.
So Dylan, I've been on your LinkedIn profile quite a bit over the last week or so. just looking through your experiences, and one thing that stands out, it's mainly all about growth and innovation, which to me is quite interesting in the world that we live in at the moment. But your experiences date back to the late 90s. So what made you so interested in growth and innovation, you know, back then? It was probably the time of the internet, when the internet was coming, a real thing, wasn't it?
Oh God, I remember having to write programs in DOS, Microsoft DOS, which was the precursor to Windows. So it was before then, I should think, my use of the internet. But no, so yeah, so obviously you mentioned that I started the Wales Fast Growth 50. And we were talking about this today about, you know, it's 26 years ago. You lot probably weren't born when I started.
No, I wasn't.
So, but what was fascinating about it then, and during the sort of mid to late 90s, I'd been working in Ireland for a long time. And well, it seemed like a long time, it's actually only a couple of years. But the work we were doing there on was how to make Ireland a more entrepreneurial nation. So when I came back to Wales, I got a professorship at the then University of Glamorgan. And the whole thing behind it was, how do we boost entrepreneurship here in Wales? And the reason behind that was that the whole of the Welsh economy at the time was focused on bringing in foreign direct investment from countries like Japan, South Korea, Germany, USA, etc. So all the focus and all the funding was going towards essentially subsidizing these very large companies to bring, you know, at then lots of jobs. But that's great, and it's still an important part of the Welsh economy. But there wasn't any focus as such on supporting, you know, local indigenous Welsh companies. So the reason we set up the Welsh Fast Growth 50 was to recognise the 50 fastest growing companies in Wales. And it was based really on something that had actually happened in the States. There's a magazine called Inc. So if anybody's listening to this and want to have a look at a great website, it's called Inc.com. But they started probably towards the end of the 80s, something called the Inc. 500, which looked at the 500 fastest growing companies in the States. And I used to use it in my teaching. So I used to teach, when I taught entrepreneurship, I'd say, look at these amazing growth companies. So I said, we should do that in Wales. But I was a bit worried I couldn't find 500 fast growth businesses in Wales. So we kept it a bit smaller and we went for the sort of the 50 companies. And so that's really where my interest started. And of course, the more you get to work with these companies every year, the more you start to understand what the opportunities, challenges, and you know, what makes up a really successful growth company.
So what does make a successful growth company?
Well, if I knew that, I'd be sitting in my villa in the Bahamas with a Nobel Prize for Economics on my mantelpiece. But I suppose there's a number of things that you wouldn't be surprised that actually make up a successful company. First of all, is having the right team. And what we've always seen when we've profiled the companies and when we talk to the entrepreneurs about what is successful, you know, the old adage is there's no I in team. It is really true here. You never hear the word I when you talk to these founders. It's always about we, and it's about the team they build around them. And it's really an important aspect that the founders who can't succeed are those who can't, what we call, let go. So they can't let go of the business. They have to do everything and they can't delegate to others. And for those who can, they grow very quickly because, like you say, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And the most important thing is to build that team around you of talented individuals who can complement your particular strengths as a founder, as an entrepreneur. So that's the first one. The second one is very clear, is understanding your market. And what we find in these fast growth companies is that they may go for quite a narrow niche market, but they understand it completely. And if that market, you know, is worth, say, £500 million, their aim is to try and get as much of that market as possible. And In some cases, they get 50, 100, 150 million pounds out of that market. And then the final one is finance. And this is interesting because finance varies because you need a lot of money at the beginning. And then when you want to go for further growth, you need a lot of money then. But you can easily reach a level, you guys are the accountants, you know this. You can reach a level where, you know, the company generates enough profit to make the founder comfortable, you know, sends their kids to a nice private school. They can even afford the 20% VATs now because they're really doing well. You know, they have a nice house. They might have a nice house somewhere else by the beach. They drive in a couple of nice cars, and that's it. So it's to get to the next step. And that's always the challenge from having a business that sort of generates enough profit. So it's that sort of gap there. And honestly, one of the problems we've got to an extent is that we don't have enough money in Wales to support startups. And we also don't have enough money to support those businesses to take the next level of growth. And we're somewhere in between. So again, those are the challenges we found right at the beginning. It's been the same challenge every year. But like I say, you know, the best companies can actually manage their finances well. They have a great team behind them and they understand their market. Oh, and one more thing, they have a vision for the future. They know where they're going and they actually have a map that shows them where they're going. And that's quite important.
I was actually speaking to a client about a month ago where he was wondering why there isn't so much venture capital interest here in Wales. He's actually had some venture capital investment himself, but he was looking around at other companies and they haven't had that much interest. Whereas, you know, I think in the States at the moment, private credit is such a huge thing where, you know, where banks are not willing to lend. You know, private credit companies seem to be investing quite a bit of money. Why don't we get that here in Wales?
Do you want to know the real reason? The real reason is venture capitalists won't drive for more than an hour outside of their centres. So basically, they're not even halfway to Birmingham before they come to turn around and go back to London on the way to North Wales.
Oh, that's simple.
Well, I'm slightly kidding, because what you tend to find is that venture capitalists cluster around where they think the most opportunities are. And of course, London is one of the, shall we say, entrepreneurial hotspots. And it sort of feeds off each other. So the more entrepreneurial opportunities you have, the more it attracts venture capitalists who then invest in those businesses, who then create more opportunities, who bring in more venture capitalists in. And I suppose the challenge is pre-COVID, the challenge was always to try and get those venture capital to look outside of London. So Wales gets about 2% of all venture capital from the UK, and we have 5% of the population, 4.5% of the business population. So we're not getting anywhere near the amounts that we should have. And the part of the challenge there, I think, pre-COVID was that, like I said, venture capitalists just wouldn't travel. Why would you? All the opportunities were there in London anyway. But now, post-COVID, there isn't actually an excuse not to do that. So I suppose our challenge in Wales is, you know, if you can't take the mountain to Mohammed, Mohammed's got to go to the mountain, as such, to use a phrase. So the whole idea is we need to be able to get our businesses in North Wales down to London and to open opportunity for them there. And I still don't think that's being done to the extent it could be done, because, you know, that I think, 400,000 Welsh diaspora living in the southeast of England. And I'm sure there's a proportion of them working in the financial services sector. So the trick is, you know, how do we open that door? Because, you know, living in South Wales, it's the same problem as in North Wales, you know, can't get the investment capital. But when you think about it, we're 1 hour, 50 minutes from Paddington Station and 20 minutes from the City of London on the Elizabeth Line. So you're not that far, but if you're in America, you've got San Francisco here and you've got San Jose here, which is where Silicon Valley, the capital of Silicon Valley. I've been there a few times. It takes 2.5 to 3 hours to drive there, but they never think of that distance as being important in making investment decisions. It's just possibly a British thing because we don't travel as far. But from my point of view, I think, yes, I'd love to have a fund just for North Wales businesses, and maybe we'll have one in the near future. But, you know, if we can't get that, then we've got some great businesses. Let's get them investment ready, take them down to London, And I'm sure, you know, they'll get as much chance of getting investment as any business in the capital city.
Well, Ryan Reynolds obviously think there's something here in Wales. I think he was interested in buying a stake in the 100 and the Welsh Fire 100 team this morning. I think that's what I read this morning. So well, there is obviously, you know, there is something here in Wales.
I'll have to ask. The chairman of Glamorgan's a good mate of mine, and he's a former investment banker. So I'm sure he will strike a hard deal with Mr. Reynolds to get the thing done. But, you know, that's an interesting point, because when you think about, you know, everybody thinks about Ryan Reynolds as an actor or as an investor in Wrexham. But, of course, he made a substantial amount of money from Mint Mobile. I think it was about $300 million. And obviously Aviation Gin, he had a substantial stake in that. So he's probably made more money out of his entrepreneurial ventures than he has from his acting. Well, at least until the new film comes out on Thursday anyway, so.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, in the Growth 50 fund, are they mostly tech companies, or are there other, no, are there all sorts? Well, what's kind of the percentage split?
I'll tell you what's interesting, because there is this sort of myth about entrepreneurship that, you know, growth companies will be tech-based. They will be young. They will be based in capital cities. And that happens, of course. But what we have found is, and this applies to Wales as much as any other part, and we, you know, we've expanded the Wales Fast Growth 50 now to another six regions and nations of the UK. And what we found was that the vast majority of them, as has been in Wales for 25 years, were in traditional sectors. So they would be business to business, you know, how another business provides services to another business, business to business services, construction and building services, retail and wholesale. And what you find is that, you know, you might occasionally get a shooting star, but those that are growing steadily and creating jobs and creating wealth, the vast majority of them are in traditional boring sectors, not sexy sectors like tech. Secondly, they're old or older. So the average age is about 12 years old. And then you find them anywhere. You know, it's not finding them around, you know, a roundabout in Silicon Roundabout in Shoreditch. You'll find them on an industrial estate in Hull. You'll find them up in the Scottish Highlands. You'll find them, you know, in the South Wales valleys. Growth can happen anywhere. And I think that's an important lesson for anybody that, you know, if you've got a good business, it doesn't necessarily have to be based in an entrepreneurial hotspot to succeed.
Do you have some really, do you have some success stories from the growth?
Oh, I'd like to claim all the credit for Admiral, because they were on our list. But as I know that the guys at Admiral, they killed me if I said that. No, I mean, Admiral is a specific success. And I remember we recognised it just before they floated. You know, and I know the team quite well, the founders quite well there. And, you know, it's a great story that they were persuaded to bring their business to Wales. It was either Brighton or Wales or Cardiff. And in those days, there was no competition. You would have gone to Brighton. And maybe the same is true now. But they were persuaded to come here for a whole range of reasons. And, you know, they built what is only the only business that's on the financial, the FT 100, the only Welsh business that's on that index. And, you know, I remember interviewing Henry Engelhardt when I was at Bangor University 20 years ago. And, you know, when you went into the company, the culture was incredible. You know, this is an insurance company. But they had a culture where people came first, right? And it was very much focused on people. And I remember they had something called the Ministry of Fun, which basically looked after events for everybody. And it was basically a great place to work. And I think, again, going back to what I said about, you know, what makes, you know, having a team successful, you know, there's this old adage in management science that says culture eats strategy for breakfast, which means that, you know, a company's culture is more important than its plan. And actually, you saw that with Admiral, that everybody wanted to work there. Everybody enjoyed working there. And of course, when they became successful, what David Stevens and Henry Engelhardt, the founders, did, they gave a proportion of the shares to the staff. And overnight, some of them became millionaires as a result. In fact, I'd always argue the reason Cardiff is so successful is not because of, say, all these public sector jobs. It's the fact that Admiral floated and all of a sudden all these millionaires and half millionaires were created who spent a lot of money in Cardiff and sort of lifted the city.
Oh, that's an interesting story. I didn't know that a lot of the staff members had shares in Admiral.
Yeah, they did, and they still do. They still give out bonuses to staff. So obviously, and I think that's a lesson for the future, that if you're going to develop a company that needs to be successful, you want to keep your best staff. Salary is not necessarily the way to do it. It's actually stock options. That's what they do in the States a lot. They give shares to, or options to buy shares to staff if the company was to be bought, for example. So that makes a real difference.
Are you sitting on any boards, any growth company boards at the moment?
Yeah, I am actually. So I chair a company called Town Square. This is the great thing about being on the Fast Growth 50, because I don't judge it. It's the market. So, you know, this is the second time I had a company I was chairing when I was at Bangor University that was on the Fast Growth 50 3 years. They grew very quickly. And then now I've got a company that will be on it for 3 years called Town Square that do co-working spaces, mainly in England. We've got a couple in Wales, but mainly in England. I'm helping out an agri-tech company at the moment down in Swansea. We're trying to raise some funding. But obviously, the other thing I'm doing is we have all our awards. We have our startup awards. We have the Fast Growth 50. The business I'm part of now, or will be part of, because we've just done a buyout, is the Great British Entrepreneur Awards and an Ideas Festival. And we're bringing all that together as one company. So I'm having to, rather than doing it part-time now, I'm going to probably be doing it more full-time than I expected to do. So I've done it before, obviously. I mean, when I invested in, it was interesting. It's when I had the bit, when I was a chairman of the business in North Wales that was on the Fast Growth 50, one of the challenges there was a cash flow issue. So I had to provide my house as security because the other founders didn't have the funding. And, you know, that is a big thing to do, but there were 60 jobs on the line. There were 60 jobs, you know, in Bethesda on the line if I hadn't done it, because the company would have gone under. Because in the end, you know, it's cash that's important. And there was that small dip. And unfortunately, the bank wouldn't support us at the time. So I had to guarantee that. I'll tell you, putting £100,000 15 years ago against the business was something I would think twice about doing now. But it was important at the time. So, you know, people sometimes say, oh, you're an academic, you haven't had skin in the game. Oh, I can absolutely assure you, I've had this entire left arm in the game, you know. When you put literally your family's future on the line because you believe in a business. And it worked out well. It could have not worked out well. But I think it's an important thing that if you believe in the business, then you have to commit to that belief.
And that's one of the things about being, you know, a founder and a business and a business person. You have to take risks, because without taking a chance or a risk, it might not even succeed. And you might think back and go, if only.
I'm going to disagree with you there, because I don't think entrepreneurs are gamblers. I have this debate. If you look about the history of entrepreneurship and when they started theorizing about it, a half Irish, half French economist called Richard Cantillon, and another one called Jean-Baptiste, another French. That's where the word entrepreneur comes from, as you guessed, right? So not from the Irish, from the French. So they came up with this whole idea of what it was about. And they said uncertainty was the key issue. Because what an entrepreneur does is take advantage of uncertainty. But then, for some reason, maybe it was in the translation, they thought uncertainty was risk. But what actually uncertainty is managing risk. So actually what entrepreneurs do is they look at an uncertain situation and they actually go out and get that opportunity. So very few successful entrepreneurs I know are gamblers, but a lot of successful entrepreneurs I know are those who have looked at the environment and said, there's an opportunity here for me to create a business and make a lot of money out of it. And so when you talk about risk, it, you know, I doubt if any entrepreneurs will go down the bookies and put any money on any horse more than 2-1 because they can't control it. So that's an interest. That's a debate for another day. But it is an interesting, you know, point that you suggested that it was about risk, whereas it's probably about managing uncertainty. If that is probably the same thing, I'm not so sure.
A debate for another day. Right. Well, the hot topic at the moment is obviously AI. I think we'd argue here that, you know, we've been trying to use AI for a couple of years.
Are you going to say, please don't say Bangor AI, okay?
I don't think that's where the term comes from. Are we using
it's
an accounting
different thing, Bangor AI, isn't it?
Quite different, yeah. So we use a software called Xero, which I think we've used for about probably 6 or 7 years ago now.
Of course.
Which I think there's quite a lot of AI built into that, which I don't think we'd use the term AI 6 or 7 years ago. Now it's so popular. How are you seeing businesses?
It was machine learning then, wasn't it? That's what they called it then. It was machine learning.
So. And I think that's what Tim Cook at Apple used for quite a while until they had their AI product, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So how are you seeing businesses using AI to their advantage, or have they seen the use case?
I don't think businesses are. And you know what? It's something that we've been using in our business here for ever since ChatGPT became live, which is what, November 22, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that's when the first version came out. And we've used different versions of AI, and we use AI a lot in, you know, because we use a lot of data. So using AI is great to actually manage it and store it and analyze it. But I think what people, I think businesses don't understand it. And there's a lot of fear-mongering out there. I think some of these businesses have been watching too many Terminator films. And remember, the Terminator films, after Terminator 2, the rest are crap, so don't watch any of the others. But I think the real challenge is that they don't understand that it's a tool, but it's a very, very intuitive tool that can actually, you know, that will, in my opinion, will have a profound effect on certain sectors. I'm not saying the accountancy sector yet, right? But you can see that, you know, the more tasks that it can take that are easily to replicate, then the easy it can actually, you know, do those tasks for you. I think the legal profession in particular, I don't think they've realized the tsunami that's coming, because it's all about, you know, legal opinion and writing contracts. And I can get a legal version of ChatGPT to write me a contract now that is as good as, you know, most lawyers would do for me. And all I need is for my lawyer to check it over, which would take half an hour, and it saves me 10 grand by doing that. So you can see the radical effect it can have on certain industries by doing that. But I think the most important thing is to look at it as an assistant, and to look at it as another tool that can help you in your business. And I think we're missing a trick here in Wales in particular, because if I was Welsh government, I would be saying, okay, I would have a target for having every business in Wales AI ready by a certain time, or a percentage of, because that will give you a real competitive advantage in the marketplace against competitors. But I think the vast majority of businesses don't know, don't care, and think that they can just operate without it. But it will. Those businesses that do will save costs, become more competitive, and will grow as a result. Because all you'll do is, you know, you won't employ people here in these repetitive tasks, but you'll employ more skilled people here to take advantage of the savings here. So it's a revolution as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah. So we just need more businesses to use it.
So do you think our government should be, like, funding some education for businesses, or, like, what would you?
I think every kid in school now, probably they're doing it already at home, right? But I think, you know, they should be taught how to use a simple suite of AI tools, because if you have that, you get a job in any business. It's just, you know, there are a set number of those tools. 2-3 years ago, I would have argued it was digital skills. And of course, you can apply digital skills in different ways. So, you know, you can have cyber skills for security. You can have, you know, Adobe Acrobat for marketing. You know, you can have Industry 4.0 things for managing manufacturing. So all those digital skills were important. But now, you know, AI's come along and it's blown them out of the water. So knowing how to use AI properly, I think, is a skill that we should be encouraging across the board, I think, even if it's extracurricular. You know, like I said, 4 years ago, it was, let's teach all the kids to code. You don't have to anymore. You just tell it, you know, tell a AI tool like ChatGPT, write this code for me to do this, and it will do it for you. You know,
I think there'll be a lot of efficiency savings for us in terms of how we generate emails to, you know, to multiple clients at the same time, how we integrate different softwares into the same, into, you know, into each other, and even just maybe even from an audit point of view as well, in terms of auto generating your sampling for you, going through the data in your audit sample.
But this is the point I was trying to make to you, because if you think about it, a lot of the, you would argue, I'm not saying that, you know, William Denton do this, but you, if you think about, you know, the role, the traditional role of accountant, you know, get the accounts in on time to HMRC, be it your corporate, you know, corporate accounts, your business accounts, or your personal accounts. Okay, traditional role, simply done, charge a certain sum, right? What it's not being done is all that value add. So when I talked about the importance of finance, you know, if you can release time and you get the right tools to support you, then you can go into a business with a full analytical tool to say, this is how you make your business more, you know, more cash effective, more, you know, how you use finance efficiently within that business in different ways. Now, if you can spend more time on that rather than doing that, whereas you're still doing that, but obviously you're still doing all the audits, but it's not as, shall we say, time consuming for the accountants to do it. The accountants can then be repurposed to do the far more value added, which for a business like yours will actually bring in more fees, bring in more income. And actually then, as I'm saying, AI has a very positive effect on a business, whereas if you looked at the beginning, we're going, oh my God, all the accountants, they're not going to be able to do audits. Well, actually, no, what you've done, you've moved it. And they're actually focusing on the real value add, which businesses will pay for because of what gives them the results. Yeah, anyway, that's your entire business strategy for the next 5 years, courtesy of no charge at all.
Well, pass that message on, I think.
Yeah, pass it back.
From a kind of a sad few articles that you've read, wrote recently, is the challenges facing universities. I have to say, I haven't read all the articles, but is it down to, you know, lack of students or lack of students coming from abroad, or, you know, what's the reason?
Bad management, basically. It's what we talked about before. You know, the challenges have always been there. So we know that, you know, that home fees have been frozen. And the problem is, as you know, as an accountant, if something is frozen, inflation will erode the value of that over time. So they've estimated now that, you know, those fees, which say around £9,000, are worth, say, £6,000, or they should be £12,000 now. And of course, it's a political decision that, you know, which government will raise tuition fees. But the biggest mistake that the university sector did was not to lobby to have it index linked. So, you know, there's then a real, if you do that, there's not going to be an eroding, sort of eroding base as such, because even though, you know, we have international students coming in, it still only accounts for about a third of the fees. And that's only recently. It was far lower. So the vast majority of money still comes in from home students. But of course, that's being eroded. So because the university sector didn't lobby for that, what happened was, of course, they had to find another source of funding. And sometimes, this is me, this is my cynical, after being in academia for 30 years, my cynical head will say, actually, they preferred it because you get three times sometimes as much income from one student from abroad as you'd get, you know, so you need three home students to equate to one international student. So maybe it was an easy thing. So, oh, we're going to lose three students, but only need one from international to make up for those three. So rather than managing them that way, they saw the opportunity, didn't do the risk. And the thing is, there is a lot of uncertainty in this because we're dealing with markets that we know nothing about, or very few about. You know, which country brings the biggest number of students? China. You know, China could turn off the tap tomorrow. President Xi could actually destroy the UK economy overnight by stopping Chinese students coming here. You know, you've got India, which has had its own difficulties. India's trying to build its own university sector. And then the third one now is Nigeria. And Nigeria's grown very quickly in the last 3 years. But what's happened? You've had a run on the Nigerian currency. The value's plummeted. And as a result, Nigerian students can't afford to come here anymore. And that's without even thinking about, you know, the policies that the last government made to restrict people coming in. So, God, it sounds complicated, isn't it? But simply put, I think what's happened is that universities did take a risk. They did bet the house on international students. And I think that whilst international students bring a lot of value, they also, and you've probably seen this in small towns like places like Bangor, they bring a lot of value to those in terms of the spending power. But then obviously, you know, there's an issue in terms of housing for local people, because obviously a lot of those houses are turned into student housing. And so there's always these tensions. And I think the most important thing that we can do, I think, in Wales is to ask a simple question, which is, what are universities for? And if we ask that question, what are universities for? They're not there to make money, to keep vice chancellors on very high salaries. Now, that is very cynical. But if you end up being there just to generate cash to keep going, then there's no point in being there. The whole point of a university is to educate the workforce of the future, to develop the knowledge that's turned into research and commercialable, and basically to have an impact on civic society around it. So if you do all those three, that's great. But if you're only existing to keep the place going, then you might as well shut it down.
Mm. Or even those subjects that there's not many students on those courses.
Well, you know what? It's interesting, isn't it? Because the cheapest subjects are those being cut. So universities all across the UK are cutting humanities. They're cutting languages. They haven't started cutting accountancy and law yet. But, you know, it's those social sciences which basically need somebody like me standing in a class teaching. That's all you need is a classroom, an academic, and that's it. Whereas already some of the more expensive subjects like science, technology, engineering, and medicine, you need to have a whole lab. It's very expensive to do that. So, but ironically, what we're losing is that. And I think we forget, you know, the importance of the arts and humanities. Because when Steve Jobs set up Apple, the reason Apple succeeded was it wasn't just a tech company. You know, if you look at the design that went behind not only, you know, the first Apples, and then when Sir Jonathan Ivey came in and designed everything else in this beautiful way, that, you know, the design and the aesthetics of that were as important as the tech. And the way when they did the fonts, and they had to get the fonts right on the very first Apples. And ever since then, you know, the reason people have Apples, because they're just cool, and they're, you know, they've just been designed in such a way that they're so user-friendly. Well, they've done that because of art students, because of design students, because of creative students. It's not necessarily because of tech. So I think we forget sometimes that, you know, if you're going to have the whole experience from a university, it's not just the science, technology, engineering, and God forbid it's all. Can you imagine if we only had business study students? My God, what a place the place would be, you know? Or even accountancy students. But, you know, it does add flavor to it adds flavor to the entire university experience. But more importantly, those individuals play a really important role in so many different ways across the board. And like I say, why close history departments? Because the one thing we know about history is that that's where you learn a lot about the future.
Right, we've got to talk about the Ideas Fest. I think we'd like to be doing a live podcast from there.
Are you guys coming?
Well, we only came. I think we only came across it the other day.
Well, you've got to come then. There we are. There's no excuse now. Now you've said. So I've got it behind me here. Look, there we go. There's the sign. There we go. So, yeah. Ideas Fest. So I'll tell you, when it's my partner Fran who's running this part of the business, and it really came. We did it 2 years ago, and we started off because basically after COVID, you know, this is an events business, so oh God, where are you going to have an event? And we thought about this idea of why don't we have something for entrepreneurs outside? So we did Ideas Fest, and we got some amazing speakers. You know, we had Stephen Bartlett speaking 2 years ago, and great thing. Steve actually stayed for just for 2.5 hours. There was a queue of 200 people wanting to speak to him. And he stood there, and it was a boiling day. And he just stood there as people came, had their selfies with him and signed this and whatever. He was incredible. We had John Caldwell, the billionaire John Caldwell. John came and talked about, you know, his experiences. And I suppose the whole thing is it's like having a conference but outside. So in the evening, we had a band. We had Fleetwood Mac. We couldn't afford Fleetwood Mac. So we had Mac instead. So they were great. And so we paused last year because we just wanted to, you know, sort of regroup and see where we're going. So we're doing it again this year. We're doing it down in Hertfordshire because we're working with one of our businesses, winners from one of our awards there. But, you know, I mean, there's a possibility to bring it to Wales in the future. But the whole idea is it's 2 days of talks and networking and just getting to know people. And that's what we found about the first one. It was that the great thing about it was you were in a field with other entrepreneurs, entrepreneurial people, and you'd be sitting down. All of a sudden, you're starting to talk about your business and find out about others. And there's all these little things going on. So he's one of our main speakers this year. But I don't know if you've heard of Michael Acton Smith, but you've probably heard about Calm, the app. So he invented Calm, you know, the most successful personal development app in the world. So Michael came down, you know, he was dressed as if he was for a festival because it was a festival. And he sat on basically a big pile of hay and just talked about his business. Now, here we are, you know, the billionaire Michael Acton Smith, one of the most successful entrepreneurs of his generation. And he's there sitting in a field talking about his business, sitting on a bale of hay, you know? And I think that's what it's about. It's about bringing these really experienced people. So the interesting one this year is going to be Simon Woodruff. So I'm sure if you like sushi, you've probably eaten in a Yo Sushi. So Simon set up Yo Sushi 20 odd years ago, then sold the majority, kept it apart, and then went away, I think to Thailand or somewhere exotic to obviously spend all his money and enjoy his life. But he's coming back now to the UK. So it'll be interesting, you know, have somebody like him talk about his experiences. And like I say, I think we've got about 80 speakers in total over 2 days. So it's like, we call it I didn't use this term, the Glastonbury for business. You know, coming from North Wales, I'd call it the Eisteddfod for business myself. But I don't think anybody outside of Wales would probably get that. But it is that. It's literally that. And of course, again, in the evenings, there'll be entertainment and food. You know, we've got all these food trucks there, a couple of bars with different. So it's just basically going to be a great time. But the most important thing is for anybody who comes there is having all these other people there and, you know, just getting to know people. Because I think that's what we're trying to do. And I think what my thinking of all our awards has changed, because, you know, an awards is great in itself and it recognizes and celebrates success. But the whole thing is, what happens afterwards? You know, I win an award, what happens afterwards? And what we've noticed is that people want to be part of a community. So I suppose this is our first step in trying to create this community going forward, is to bring people together in a field in Hertfordshire, right of all places, and next to a beautiful big hotel. So obviously the hotel's there for facilities. It's not really in a field, it's a field next to a hotel. But it will have, you know, two big tents, smaller tents, things going on. I think the oddest thing, I never thought, right, that I'd basically be sitting in an office where I'd be discussing whether we should have a bucking rodeo bull or a bucking rodeo camel as entertainment that evening. You know, this is what I spent 6 years of my life doing a PhD for, you know, to decide what are we going to have, the bucking bull or the bucking camel. I don't know. Anyway.
So which one are you going for?
We're not too sure. They've actually got a bucking flying carpet as well. So I don't know. My inner Sinbad is coming out here, you know, thinking that maybe could I actually stay on a bucking flying carpet? I'm not too sure. But but it's elements of that. But it is really, you know, the more serious part, it's about the learning. It's about the experience. And again, you know, from your point of view, the most important thing that people who work with entrepreneurs can do is to go out and, you know, mix with them. And this is a great opportunity. So, you know, tell those who are in charge of the purse strings that you've spoken to me and you're going to come.
That sounds good.
That actually sounds like my kind of festival.
It's pretty cool. We've got, I'm now too old for this sort of thing, but they've got this band called the Shorehawk Duo, who actually do club hits from the 90s on acoustic guitar.
Oh, okay.
I've actually seen them at Green Man last year, and they are really good. Not my music, but apparently everybody else wants them there. So there we are. That's the sort of thing that'll be going on. I'll be in the bar having a beer. So,
what was the turnout for it last time?
It was about, over the 2 days, about 2,000 people. So that's the aim again this time. So, you know, it's to, like I say, it's the more important thing, you know, is making sure that people get the opportunity. We're also doing our startup awards at the same time. So because we decided rather having two separate events, and we've got a tent, and if you've got a tent, why can't you do an award ceremony in it? So we've got a tent spare in the evening. So we're going to do that, the startup awards there as well. And this year it's going to be the UK startup awards. So there are 30 companies from Wales coming over. I think they're about 7 or 8 from North Wales. So the whole idea is to bring everybody together. So it's great to have the best of Wales, but when the best of Wales compete against the best of the UK and they're representing, you know, I'm not buying, you know, like a uniform for them, like the Olympics, so they can't have a Wales badge on it to represent Wales. Although they probably will now I've suggested it. But, you know, the important thing is that what I want to show is that there's excellence across the whole of the UK when it comes to new businesses. Because if I was to do it just as the UK awards, whether we like it or not, the majority of the businesses would come from London. What we've done is democratized it in a certain way. Like, it's all the winners from each of the regions. So, you know, if there's like AI, for example, you mentioned AI. We had 1,600 entries this year. 160 of them were AI related. 10%.
10%, wow.
Which is unprecedented. So if you're an AI business from London, you are the best in London. If you're an AI business in Wales, you're the best in Wales. So you're not going to have 8 from London and then, oh, we'll try and fit somebody else in. That's the way we're doing it. A bit like it's a knockout for entrepreneurs or something like that.
Oh, we're not doing it's a knockout this year, are we? I don't think it's on, but it's a knockout. It's good fun. Right, well, before we let you go, is there anything kind of you're reading, watching, our listeners should be aware of?
God, no, you don't want to see what I'm watching on Netflix. Or Amazon, or Apple, or whatever. I don't know. I suppose I'm big into biographies, and I've started reading the Elon Musk biography, which is fascinating. I mean, you know, trying to get into the minds of people who are going to change the world is quite interesting. I don't think we've even realized what Musk is going to achieve. I just wish he'd keep out of politics, which is what I'm doing now. I'm not keeping out of politics by saying that, am I? But I really wish he would, because, you know, what he's done for electric cars and what he's doing, I don't think what we understand what he's going to do for the space industry. And again, it's something I think Wales is a bit behind on. We created a special category this year in the Startup Awards because we saw all these amazing space startups, but there weren't enough in one area to have a competition. So we did a special award. We've got about 8 or 9, we've got about 9, 10 of them. I think we've got 10 of them. We're competing from all over the UK for the best space tech startup. But, you know, again, I don't think we realise what's going on there. And you know, that really is a fascinating future. And like I say, I think Musk, the way that the private sector is now has taken over, essentially, the space industry, that's going to create some really interesting opportunities for the future. And hopefully an opportunity that we can grasp here in Wales. But we haven't so far.
I'm halfway through that same book at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I must say I'm enjoying watching House of the Dragon for the simple reason most of the parts of North Wales I love is actually featured on it. So I suppose that's one programme I'm watching. I think like I said to you before, you know, if anybody from business is listening to this, I subscribe. You can subscribe on your iPad to Inc. and you get the magazine and it's great to read it like that. But the website for Inc.com is really special. And, you know, maybe that's what we want to do. I mean, one of my passion projects for next year is to create something where we can get all these stories of these entrepreneurs in one place, because we have them obviously with all our awards and everything we do. But I think we are, you know, I mean, Wales, we're a nation of storytellers in so many ways. But I think there's some great stories there. And I think you learn a lot from the stories of entrepreneurs. And we've done it in sort of a fashion in the past, but I want to make it better. And I want to be able to have something where if you guys, you know, thinking, oh, I want to find out about an AI company in Scotland run by a female university graduate. Boom. AI, five of them come up from there. So you can get that and you get the experience, because that's what you want to do. Because you may be a female graduate who's wanting to start an AI business, but you want to get that experience from those stories. So that's one of the passion projects I think I'm going to try and do next year. But if I've got time. I have got a really big project, but I can't tell you about it. I'll have to do it again in North Wales.
Oh, you'll have to come on again then.
Yeah, we'll watch this space. It's going to be... I'm working with a very successful entrepreneur. We're going to basically do something in North Wales over the next 3 months that's going to transform the entrepreneurial landscape for North Wales. Now, I really left you with something now, haven't I?
Ooh, we'll look out for it.
But, you know, very successful North Walian entrepreneur. And he's an investor in the business now. We're working together to now create this. It's actually a philanthropic sort of project that's going to be driven by the private sector. So he's going to be investing in it. We're going to drive it forward. But I think it's going to have a massive splash and a massive impact. And I'll tell you all about it next time. Okay.
Great. We look forward. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
It has been my absolute pleasure.
We'll speak soon. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.